What is most of your work? It's not, is it teaching or designing the courses or administering the course? I'm not quite clear exactly what you spend most of your time doing.
I currently work in the library, and that's the work of a librarian, cataloging books and working with students and teachers and with all the colleagues. I can design some courses, and I can, for example, I can encourage the teachers to implement new methods, and I can encourage them to develop professionally, but I'm not a course designer, actually. When I was a teacher, I designed the materials, and I wrote the book for aviation English for third and fourth year students. But now I work in the library, and I'm more interested in designing materials for my private courses. And maybe at school, but I'm not sure, because our teachers are not trained for TBLT. They are not willing to implement this, but I'm going to try to encourage them to do that.
Good. How many teachers are there?
There are about 100 teachers.
What?
100.
100? My goodness. Wow. That's enormous.
Yes, this is a secondary state school, not aviation for pilots and controllers. This is a state school, but we are going to have a bilingual class next year, and I can design some classes. I can create materials and prepare some task-based lessons in the library, for example, about reading materials, reading newspaper articles on science. I think this is very useful for our students because of the collocations and practicing learning collocations, and because that is a great problem, I think. That's why I am thinking of preparing some task-based lessons in the library. So I think that getting students to read a lot of various articles of a good quality that are relevant to them would be much more effective than doing lexical exercising in the commercial course books they use now.
I thought your output task for the materials thing was fantastic. A really very nice set of materials for the task that you wrote. Is
Yes.
that did you do that just for this program, or had you already done some of that work?
I don't know how to explain that, because I wrote the book
I know.
with some materials that was on aviation terminology and vocabulary practice. But
Yes.
now, during the course, this course, I've learned a lot about how to do needs analysis and deriving target tasks and pedagogic tasks and so on. And I applied that knowledge in making those materials.
Yeah,
So
fantastic.
I like to change my book on aviation English, and to design this that way, as I've done that exercise, that materials.
Great.
But I'm
I was talking to Neil. I said we must get you to help us with our materials bank. Once we've finished this course, we have to keep in touch with you. And you know, we're developing a task-based materials bank. of special materials, like the one. Sorry, Diana, one second.
Yeah.
Sorry, I put the, anyway, yes, we're trying to, well, we're working with Mike Long and with Roger Gilavert, mm-hmm. and the people at the SLB, that's the cooperative in Barcelona, the Surveys Linguistics Barcelona, and that's our kind of, well, I call it a plan. It's more of a dream than a plan at the moment, but that's the idea. We want to create a bank of materials, because obviously one of the biggest problems when we encourage teachers to try TBLT, well, Long's version, is that, you know, it's the material. They say, well, what, you know, how are we going? We haven't got the resources to make our own materials in the way that Long suggested. So that's our idea, is to try to collect materials that will make it easier. It won't do the job. It won't be like, you know, like here's a course book, but at least it'll go some way, so that they don't have to start from zero, as it were. You know, those people who are interested in doing TBLT can look at things like yours and other people's, and that will kind of, we hope, trigger them, and, you know, they say, oh, I could use this and so on. Let me do this share screen. And where am I? It's there. No, there.
Yes, I can see.
Can you see it? All right. Yeah. So look, we said that what we were going, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear, but yes, I can see now. Yes.
Yeah, you can see where it says, this session tutorials will be an open discussion on Long's MPs and methodological principles and pedagogic. Yeah. So, pedagogic procedures. What about the first question? Does the distinction between methodological principles and pedagogic procedures make sense to you?
Yes, it does. To me, it makes
sense. Okay. Should more be said, do you think, about the pedagogic procedures?
As I understood that, it depends on the context, and the teachers all over the world can use some procedures that are suitable for their students, for example. So I think in Long's book and in your presentation, it is very explained in great detail. So I don't think it should be said more about pedagogic procedures. I don't know. Really, it's completely clear to me.
Right. You know, he says that he took the idea behind it is to get away from the kind of confusing terms of methodology, approach, and I forget what the other term is, because, you know, they're often asked, for example, I know Scott Thornbury says dogma is not a method. And I think Michael Lewis said the lexical thing is not, it's an approach. And I never understood what the difference between approach and method was, really. And I think that Long felt the same way, and that's why he decided that he'd make a distinction between, well, like the principles are putatively universal. you know, it's the idea is those 10 principles apply to anybody anywhere, which is, I think, quite daring, you know. And then in terms of the pedagogic procedures, I think he's quite right to be kind of cautious and say it's not for me or for anybody to tell a teacher in his or her particular context precisely how these methodological principles should be implemented. So it does seem to me, I must say, I think he's quite right about it. But the problem is when we actually go to implement them. I don't know if you saw, did you see that tweet? Somebody said, well, look, with reference to Long's methodological principles, somebody, I forget who it was, said on Twitter, these principles are common to lots of different approaches to ELT. And I said, well, I don't think they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they said, oh, well, for example, the very first one, what is it, that task, not, use task, not text as the unit of analysis. I mean, I don't know any other method or that adopts that principle, do you?
I don't know either. I think that, yes, I don't agree with those person who put that, who wrote that on Twitter, because pedagogic procedures are completely, for TBLT, are specific, completely different, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose in terms of the second one, promote learning by doing, that sounds pretty down, it's pretty general. Oh, yeah, well, we all agree with that. But in fact, they don't. You know, they say they do, but they don't. In my opinion, and Long says that choosing task as the unit of analysis goes naturally with learning by doing. You know, whereas the other the people, the course books and so on, they say, oh, yes, we agree learning by doing, but it's contradicted by what actually happens in the classroom, it seems to me. But anyway, do you think that it's in this second thing here? It says, what's your opinion of Long's distinction between the methodological principles and the pedagogical procedures? Does that work for you, or you think it's too... too vague?
I don't think it is vague. I think it is completely different because methodological principles are universal, as you said, and pedagogic procedures are completely specific and different. For example, the teachers who used presentation practice, presentation, the PPP method, methodology, they teach in completely different ways and use completely different pedagogic procedures than from the teachers who use TBLT methodology. So I completely understand the distinction here.
Yeah, and what about this second question there? Does it imply that anything goes at the local classroom level?
There are differences in pedagogic procedures, but it is related to the methodology and methodological principles that you use. For example, if you apply TBLT, I think that in all contexts, people or teachers should use similar pedagogic procedures, especially if they use a strong TBLT.
Yeah.
Needs analysis and target discourse, discourse analysis, and so on, pedagogic tasks, and it is the same pedagogic procedures if you use CBLT, I think, if I understand that clearly. And methodological principles are universal, yes, but pedagogic procedures are they different if you use TBLT methodology in different contexts? I don't know. Can you explain that to me?
Right. One of the, I think, yes, the session 11 is actually dedicated to the question of focus on form. Because I think that's one of the most controversial of the methodological principles. And I think, well, we've talked before, and we'll talk next session about, how strict should we be in this avoidance of explicit grammar teaching. Mm-hmm. So Long says, as you know, the idea of focus on form is that it's reactive, that you don't do it in advance, you react to problems that come up as the students are involved in a task. Long is very keen on various kinds of negative feedback, you know, like recasts and, yes, and stuff like that.
Or clarification, for example. Is that a negative clarification and recasts?
Yes, that's it. And he is not in favor of giving presentations on, you know, present perfect versus past, for example. Well, a lot of teachers say, well, if I don't do any of that, I get a lot of problems from both sides, from the parents and the young learners, or from the learners themselves if they're adults, and also from the boss, either the director of studies or the principal or whoever it is. So, and what's more, quite a few people doing this course, I think, and you know, the people doing this course in a way are predisposed towards accepting Long's position, more or less. Nevertheless, a lot of them, I think, still have this underlying feeling that one should do a certain amount of explicit grammar teaching. And I think, as I say, Neil will be leading the next session on that. But for the moment, what in your particular context, is there some sort of expectation that teachers talk about grammar?
I think that the greatest problem is teacher reluctance. They're not willing to change their methods and to try something new. I'm not sure that the bosses or something else is the problem. I think the teachers should be much better trained, and they should have much better training, and they should try some new methods. They're not willing to try, and I think that explicit grammar learning is useless, and those lessons used on grammar explanations are ineffective, and the students are completely blocked from speaking and trying to make conversations. There are years of grammar teaching, for example. When we go to on a school trip. They can't say anything in, or for example, they can use English in some situations, in some simple situations, in order to, for example, ask some simple questions. And they are, for example, B2 level, and then they can't make conversations. Our teachers, when they, for example, me, when I studied English a long time ago, when I graduated, I knew a lot about grammar, but I couldn't make a conversation. And that's the problem. If I had a lot of implicit learning, that would be much better. Maybe that would be very good if some experts or linguists could explain to, for example, they could give some training to students and parents to on learning. On implicit language learning, because they don't know, they spend a lot of time and money, and they got a lot of useless lessons, I think.
Yes, I agree. I think I agree. In the end, I think you're right. I think it's teachers kind of say, "Oh, I can't do that because." You know, the students expect it or my boss expects it. But in the end, I think you're right. I think they're not prepared. You know, it's just like they think that's my job. That's what I do. I'm, you know, an English teacher teaches grammar. That's what we do. And it's really difficult to persuade them that the best way to help somebody get sort of competent and proficient in using a second language is by, you know, doing things in it, not studying the damn thing. And then that's a really hard one to get across. But anyway, we're trying. What about maybe the biggest question of the lot in Nong's chapter 10, on methodological principles and pedagogic procedures. Which one is it? Is it number 7 or the chunk learning? Encourage, I've got the book in front of me here. MP5, encourage inductive chunk learning. And he's actually devotes quite a lot of, quite a few pages to that.
Yes.
Without, it seems to me, coming to any really firm, clear, practical conclusions, you know, in the end, he says it's very, very important, but it's a bit of a problem because there are so many chunks. Bits of, you know, so many to learn, and they seem to be one of the more difficult areas for learners to get hold of. So, what does one do? When you read there, what do you think? Do you think he says here, for example, it's clear that the methodological principle is very well motivated given the importance of collocations in learning, but it's equally unclear how best to realize it into practice. In other words, which pedagogic procedures to call upon. He gave two examples, and he also says, of course, which is Krashen's sort of big thing, extensive reading is really important. But in terms of what do you do, you know, in the classroom, and how do you implement what pedagogic procedures in what way can you encourage inductive chunk learning? And it seems to me, as I say, he doesn't give any very clear practical solutions. That he gives two, I think, very nice examples. Mm-hmm. And he suggests extensive reading. And he suggests also, I suppose, to the extent that you do a good needs analysis, that will identify some, you know, really essential chunks that, so for example, in your case,
in aviation, technical terminology, and it is not so difficult to do need analysis and to identify this course and to do a discourse analysis. And I think that our school library is a great resource, learning resource. And we could, for example, do some task-based lessons in the library. And for example, on searching for and reading some scientific articles found on the internet or in some scientific magazines or reference books in the library. I think that it's a good way of practicing some chunks and collocations. And the best way of, I think, expose our students to sufficient exposure of collocations is to motivate them to read outside of the classroom and to find the articles on the net and to read the scientific articles or books. I think the lessons are not enough for practicing collocations and chunks.
Have I seen a photograph of your library? Did you put a photograph up once? I think. I see a photograph? It's very nice, isn't it, your library?
Yes, it's very nice. It has it's very large and it has a space for reading, and extensive reading is possible. It is possible to prepare some lessons on extensive reading, for example. But the problem is our students are motivated only to study and learn for tests and for grades. And it is very difficult to motivate them to read more. And to, for example, they don't read scientific articles, and it is the problem. Now, I'm thinking of preparing some tasks next school year based on task-based TBLT. And I'm not sure if I would be successful.
Well, I'm sure you are. When your library, you're talking about a secondary school or the university?
This is a secondary school library, but it is there is a lot of space and a lot of we have computers and the internet. Yes. Internet connection. Yes.
How many people are at the school?
How many people? About 850 students.
Fantastic. And 100 teachers?
Yes, about 70-80 teachers, maybe
fantastic. Is it a private or state school?
It is a state school with some private license on the courses, aviation courses, but we are not so successful because our country is not so, I don't know, you know a lot about the political situation, so I'm not going to explain that.
Well, I don't know. I'm when I was there, it was very different. It was still Tito was there, and it was still one country. It was Yugoslavia.
Yugoslavia was a beautiful country.
Yes,
it was communist but beautiful. But now that's a great political economic problems and not so good.
Yes. But the education always struck me. I had a marvelous time with the university people. They're very, very clever people I met in New York. They were wonderful. Marvelous chess players. And anyway, you are responsible for taking these students up until university entrance, are you?
Yes.
And that you say they'll only read if they think that that will help them with their university entrance exams.
Sorry, I didn't understand. They read only if they. Can you read?
I got the impression you said to me, talking about what do we do to help people with inductive chunk learning. Mm-hmm. The best way possibly is extensive reading. But you said to me, the problem with your students is that they don't read very much.
Yes.
Unless it's because they think it'll help them with a test, with their grades.
Yes, only they study only for tests and grades. They're not so, they don't have intrinsic motivation to learn. That's the great problem. Very few students come to the library and they are very interested in reading, in science, in knowledge.
Yeah.
Precious. But most of students are interested only in grades, which is demotivating.
Yes, well, that's you know, that's the way it is. So you next year, you think you might try to do a few tasks that involve some extensive reading?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think that's I know Crashen, in my school, when I was in Isadi, we met Crashen came, and I'm very impressed with Crashen. I think his theory as a theory is full of holes, but I think most of what he says is very good indeed, and I particularly like his insistence on the value of extensive reading. And when he came to Isadi in Spain, Barcelona, he said, if the teacher believes in the value of extensive reading, then his or her students will do it. And I think, you know, I was very bad at it. I used to always, you know, I used to say, go into class and say, what are you reading? And they'd all say nothing, or one or two. But I realize now that I didn't really make enough effort. And I met one teacher who was passionate about it, and he really believed that everybody had to read, and his students did it. He used to go in the first day of every course, and he'd give everybody a book. If they're lower levels, they were graded readers. But in any case, that's how he started. And he said, you're going to finish that this week. And he just insisted. And he went on and on. And people did it. And they thanked him in the end. They said, that's, you know, even people who didn't read in their own language started reading in English just because he was so fanatical, you know, and so evangelist, and he really believed it, and they did. And I think that's probably true. I think if you really, really see the value of extensive reading, probably you can persuade your students to do more than most teachers, and I include myself, are not really, you know, they don't make enough effort to pass the habit on to their students, maybe. I don't know. Well, anyway, so we're not terribly sure, at least I'm not, what to do about inductive chunk learning. As you know, I have a terrible time with Della and other people who take this lexical approach.
Yeah, I know.
They focus on teaching lexical chunks. And it seems to me...
This is useless to teach lists of words and vocabulary like that, I think.
I always say, what is the principle behind it? Is it frequency? You know, is that it? If you say, okay, I'm going to do the 100 most frequent? And it's not even that. They don't, you know, it's just hopeless. It's, what it really strikes me as being very close to is like phrase books, you know, the sort of thing that they used to give people when they went on holiday, you know. Mm-hmm. My bed is too small, and the stuff, how much is, and so on. But anyway, okay, so here's the last one. How can we promote cooperative, collaborative learning and individualized instruction?
Mm-hmm. How can we promote cooperative, collaborative learning? I am doing a lot on promoting collaborative learning between teachers and as I told you, a library is a perfect place where we can do some projects and collaborative learning, but I'm not sure I understood the text about collaborative learning here and individual instruction. What's the...
Yes. Yeah.
This about the individual instruction, I didn't manage to read. I didn't have time to read it.
Yeah.
The learners learn much more if they do it collaboratively, if they cooperate. For example, group work or peer work is very good in TBLT, but I'm not sure about the individualized.
Yes, this is rather philosophical. So Long comes from a very left-wing political ideology. He's an anarchist, like me.
Yes. I love that.
But he... What he means, what is, I was very, very involved in Breen's process syllabus when I was in ISADI. And that is really learner-centered. And in fact, the learners decide the syllabus. They you know, that's what it is. Long thinks that's not right. That's not appropriate. He thinks they haven't got the knowledge to make those decisions, and he thinks it ends up with just, not well-focused classroom interaction. He thinks it's better for the domain experts with the teacher to design a syllabus based on a needs analysis so that the syllabus consists of target pedagogic tasks. So to that extent, he's not in that line, that really radical line like Breen, and even to some extent other ones, even Dogme gives the impression of being more learner-centered, more collaborative learning, more individual, in that they bring in their own materials and they set the agenda and so on. So there are approaches to ELT that seem more radical, more learner-centered, more like that than Long. But what Long means by cooperative collaboration or collaborative learning is that everybody works on the task. But
yes,
we, the teachers and those running the course, design the syllabus. So we say, okay, here's a task, but the task is built around cooperative, collaborative learning. So Gapville and the rest of it. So I think the principle is perfectly consistent. Some people say he's just giving token nod in it. So that's not true. He means it seriously, and he says that what we should be doing is promoting cooperative, collaborative learning in the sense that everybody is equally part of it. It's not an individualistic who's the top of the class, who gets the highest mark, and the usual values that you get in competitive capitalist run schools, where it's a meritocracy and the winner gets a prize and the one at the end is an idiot and so on. He rejects all those values and embraces the values of Kropotkin and other educationists who say, no, this is a collective enterprise. So I think it's perfectly rational and consistent and coherent view. As for the individualizing instruction, well, obviously, what this means is that it's based on a needs analysis. It's not this one size fits all. It's not a course book. It's not, you don't have the stereotypical family living in London, a mum and a dad and a boy and a girl, and the girl cooks and the boy plays football and the father, and all that. So what he says, individualized instruction means that it's based on individuals' needs. All the people in that course have been consulted about what they need and what they want to do with the language. And to that extent, it's individualized. He's actually in the book, philosophical underpinnings, l'éducation integrale. I don't know how to, I suppose that's my hopeless attempt at, do you speak French?
No, I don't.
Chapter 4 in his book is called Philosophical Underpinnings.
Yeah.
And he takes his cue from l'éducation, however you say that in French, and it's the French tradition actually then that he's the revolutionary French from the French Revolution and on, the anti-bourgeois, the collective view of education. And it's a lovely chapter, very, very nicely done. And he had a huge fight with his publishers. The publishers really didn't want to publish all this, wing anarchist Kropotkin. Oh dear. But he insisted, and because he's so well known, he's such a big name, they said, I think they forced a few changes on him, but it's a very brave book, I think it's marvelous in the sense that it does represent very radical, cooperative, non-capitalist, non-individualistic, non-competitive view of education and society. Well, there we are. So how can we promote all that? I think he would say, it obviously depends so much on each situation. How do you feel in your situation? Do you feel pretty free to do what, do you think you can let, you can, you've got a lot of freedom?
Yes, I've got a lot of freedom and I like my job because of that. And I can write my blog and I have complete freedom to plan my time in the library. But the problem is teachers who are too conformistic, not interested in changing things. And I don't know how to encourage them to be more interested in some new methods and something better. I tried to apply communicative approach, and among 10 teachers, I was the only one who wanted to change things. the other nine teachers were against that. They were for grammar teaching method. That was my problem. I was a kind of anarchist in my school. That was not a burnout. I tried to change the things by working in the library and to promote new things through professional development through my blog and something like that. And maybe I'll manage to do something in a few years. I don't know. Some things are changing, but very slowly in my school.
And how is it now in Belgrade? Is it still a lovely place to live?
I'm not sure. I'm not so. I have a very bad government, and I don't know if you read or know anything about the political situation here, but it's very bad. Our government is not so good.
So it's still a beautiful city, right?
Sorry.
Still a beautiful city.
It is a beautiful city.
And lovely people.
Yes.
I miss Belgrade.
You're very
I had some of the best times of my life in Belgrade. It was just fantastic. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed myself. I was young.
Why did you leave London? Oh, sorry, not London, but England. Why did you leave England then and the communist country?
Yeah, I was involved in very radical politics, and I was arrested by the police. I was charged with disrupting the life of the university and all sorts. I had a lot of problems. And in the end, I thought, and especially when Margaret Thatcher came to be prime minister, it was horrible. And so I thought it was a terrible place to be. And when Thatcher, she really destroyed so much. She destroyed the trade unions, she destroyed the National Health Service, she destroyed the school educational system. Just terrible. And I, as I say, I had a few problems. And I also I was just very keen to try Yugoslavia and go and see my friends. I met a lot of people in Hvar, you know, the island.
Hvar, beautiful island.
Yeah, and they invited me. I met these people who lived in Belgrade, and they had their holiday every year in Hvar. So I went one summer, and then and I accepted their invitation to come to Belgrade. And I set up with a flat with a friend, and we made a deal. The deal was I said I would teach you English, and you teach me chess. So he taught me chess not so well. My fault. I taught him English. His English is very good. A lot better than my chess.
He was lucky.
I must come back, actually. I really must. I want to see. I'm not sure what if I return to Belgrade. I left Belgrade in 1973. So how long is that? 73, 83, 90, what's that, 14? 45 years. So I'd probably have a terrible shock if I went back. It must have changed a lot, right?
Yes, it changed a lot, but not for better, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I don't think London has changed for the better. And I don't think Barcelona has changed for the better. In fact, I can't think of anywhere that's changed for the better. I think, you know, it's a for them.
What are the best years? The last century, 1980s or 70s, yeah. Or 80s, and then neoliberal politics, I think.
Capitalistic politics changed. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. I was, in the universities in the 1960s when we were completely crazy, you know, we were all...
Yeah, I can imagine.
It was a lovely time. Anyway,
70s, that was
There'll be another one tomorrow morning if you want to join Neil about this, if you have any questions or anything. Otherwise, I'll see you later in the week.
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye.